everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we take on a serious issue, have panelists on who have something important to share, and today we're taking a slight diversion from that. Not that this is not an important issue, it is. We are going to look at the history of one of the most important historical progressive radio networks in American history, if not the beginning of the entire movement to bring alternative voices, those that will champion freedoms the mainstream media has been shy or reluctant to discuss or to get behind. The Pacifica Radio Network are five stations: KPFK in Los Angeles, KPFA in Berkeley, California, by San Francisco, WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., and KPFT in Houston, Texas. I have been on the air every day for 39 years, the longest-running daily program in non-commercial radio history, and nearly 40 years on Pacifica. In that period of time, I've had a chance to see the highs and lows of what occurs at Pacifica. I am more interested in what my guests have to share on this topic with oral histories. This is not meant to be a debate or an argument, because every single person who's had experience with Pacifica as a host, a producer, as a member of a local station board or national board member, as executive director or program director or station manager, has their own unique concept of what Pacifica stands for and what their relationship has been. None of us have the same context nor relationship, but we all have experiences, and it's from those that we can get an idea of how did we go from being the most respected network providing alternative voices on major issues to one that is completely, totally irrelevant. I watched many indices and indicators of the ebb and flow of media. It's always been a hobby of mine, and hence I've subscribed to Arbitron and get the listings of how shows do. Plus, we have Google Analytics, which are far more accurate, because the Arbitrons only take a snapshot of one group of people in a given city at a given time and then try to break it down and then extrapolate from that forward. Well, that can be extremely inaccurate. However, it's what the media uses. There was a time back in 1997 through 2001 that WBAI was dominant. We were ahead of NPR. We were ahead of their best program, like All Things Considered. And it's where people came. A few thoughts about that. I can remember we had managers who had backgrounds in radio and media. We had an outstanding manager in Rosemary Mealy. If you wanted to hear the best conversations on culture, whether it was music, opera, writing, poetry, you listened to the media programs, the arts and entertainment programs. Rick Harris directed that. At any given evening, you could win the studios of BAI on 35th Street and 8th Avenue and see performances being pre-recorded or live. If you wanted to hear the finest program, the most insightful and sensitive, exciting and accurate program on spirituality and comparative religion, you listened to Lex Hickson. If you wanted the best science program in the media, period. As a scientist, I can tell you I never met anyone as good as Eileen Zalist, who would fly in to do her program and fly back out again. She had the best program. You had morning people, Larry Josephson, urbane, articulate, his own unique form of sarcasm. But his hand was on the pulse of what people wanted to hear who were more hip. And that's how it went throughout the day. Today, before coming on the air, I stopped to get a juice, as I normally do. And a man came over and said, "I'm going to be listening to your program this evening." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I began listening to WBAI in the 1960s. At that time, as he's a just recently retired professor of history, he said, I could hear the most stimulating conversations by people who knew what they were talking about, and there was a sense of fairness. And I remember specifically listening to programs only on WBAI in New York that addressed Zionism as compared to Judaism. And he said you couldn't hear that anywhere else. No one would touch that topic. If anyone else in any other part of the media wanted to touch Zionism, you were considered an anti-Semite or self-hating Jew. Only WBAI had the courage to address those issues. And I said, well, I have listened to the other stations, and it's not unique to BAI. You could hear that type of discussion on any of the Pacifica stations at that time. But Pacifica has morphed. And as a result today, we have stations that are in complete free fall. The question is, can they be saved? Is it worth saving? Why should we care about Pacifica when Pacifica clearly has lost interest in being relevant to the majority of its listeners? As this man said, he said, as a educated liberal Jew living in New York, all of us that I knew supported BAI. None of us supports it today because they went from having open and honest discussions to that which was inarticulate. It was self-promoting and a great deal of anti-Semitic activity. He said, I just went on to other media. He is not an isolated person. There are many reasons why we are at this abyss. Let me just give you the headline and a brief statement from one newsletter that was widely distributed earlier this year. The title of the emailing was, Is the Legendary Pacifica Radio Network About to be Dismantled? And then it went on to the quote, the threat to the Pacifica network. It talked about a rogue board, meaning a majority of the national board that oversees the foundation, had in effect seized control of Pacifica Radio Network and was going to do with it what it wanted. And what did this person say or claim that the majority wanted to do? They wanted to sell off WBAI and PFW in Washington and KPFT in Texas, take that money, which could be $100 million or more, and use it for whatever they chose to use it for on KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. I have seen at least 50 different types of challenges to what's going on at Pacifica. There is no question that Pacifica has had some extraordinarily insightful, humanistic, very intelligent individuals who've had background and experience in fundraising, in non-commercial radio, in business, in all the different disciplines that are represented on the air, and more often than not, their voices are not listened to. People who could have long ago turned the foundation around and helped it have been dismissed out of hand or attacked. And one of the techniques that have been used by those who fought for power, much like a turf war between the Blood and the Crips, is the elections, which in my opinion are completely worthless, if not out-and-out fraudulent. Because if you're really going to do something that is supposed to be democratic, to represent all the listeners, the different factions of the listeners, then it's not what has ended up. You have factions that are supported by dominant groups and generally two different factions with a few independents, and all they do is clash. Watching a Pacifica national board meeting or a local station board meeting is like watching a group of scorpions in a cocktail glass fight each other. Nothing gets done. When you ask about the background of the people who manage the stations, program directors and others, where is their background that shows that they have deep experience in this field? What is missing from Pacifica? Aside from just good programming, you have outstanding programming with a few shows and unlistenable programming for many. Why is it that historically the really good shows have been purged and the really progressive minds expunged from the history of Pacifica? And people who are part of these turf wars, frequently with no background in broadcasting, non-commercial radio, none of the qualities that require radio program to be listenable. They get on the air, and then they fight like hell to keep their position, or the people that put them there fight like hell to keep their position. So trying to get a unlistenable, unprofessional program off is a virtual impossibility. To get poor management changed almost is impossible. And so we get to the point where we have an ungovernable mess. The audience has not abandoned us lightly. We have had to assault them, insult them, deny them, and abuse them regularly, repeatedly, and with malice aforethought. And I do not say that in a flippant manner. When you know you're not going to send a premium, and yet you take the person's money, promise them a premium, that premium may be a life-saving premium, maybe something that's not just a mug or a CD, but something that they need, because people will generally respond to those premiums that are most important to them, and then they don't get them. In fact, it's gotten so bad that at a recent conference, I asked a group of listeners, how many of you have paid for premiums you did not receive? Every single hand went up. When I said, how long has it been and how many? One woman had not received a premium in 2 years, and she had pledged 9 times. But, she said, as others laughed, that'll be the last time I support the station. Right now, the station is so handicapped by cash flow deficiency because it has not been sending premiums out in a timely manner that people are simply listening but not supporting because they don't believe that they'll get their premiums. That's a major problem. So you have an elderly core small audience, so small that in some prime times you have just a few hundred people listening. What does it say when your prime hours in the morning, you have more people that frequently are on a bus corner waiting for a bus in New York than listening to a 50,000-watt station that's over 55 years old in the middle of the dial? That is a disgrace. It is a disgrace to the entire management, to the programming director, to the station manager, to the national board, because they allowed it to happen, because nobody wanted to make a step backwards and see, are we doing this right? As a result, people with, I'm sure, their own self-righteous determination that what choices they were making were the correct choices have been in power. I remember when I was told that my services were no longer needed, and it was in an email after 27 years, I said, fine, not a problem. I left the next day. I was flooded with calls of stations that were happy to have me on board. And of all the stations, I chose WNYC. Very shortly, we became number one on that. My audience came with me. How many? Estimated conservatively 47,000 people left BAI and stopped pledging. Never once since then have they raised even a small portion of what they're supposed to. We used to raise $1,100,000 in 10 days. We never even had a show that had to be played twice in the same drive. We prided ourselves in being able to reach our goals and then supply our premiums. But those days are long gone. Right now, all the stations are in cash crisis. They're in cash crisis because of all the mistakes they've made. The remainder of our program will be to identify these problems of how we got here and what is possible to turn this around. I will save my thoughts to the very end on what I believe is the future of all the Pacifica stations, but principally WPFW in Washington, WBAI in New York. Because right now I do not believe that three of the five Pacifica stations will last a year from now in their current incarnation. And I'll explain why. To say, hopefully, that we can change it, we can correct it, with optimism, we can improve it, is to be living in a delusion and mocking reality. It's time for that wake-up call. My first guest today is Summer Rees. Summer Rees is the former executive director of Pacifica Foundation. That's the highest authority as far as a policymaker and the overseer of Pacifica. And she was the chairperson of the national board for 3 years. She was summarily fired. And she was with us last week, was extremely articulate, Now we want to see her history of what she sees the problems being. Nice to have you with us again, Summer.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be back. I appreciate that. I mean, the history of the problems, it kind of depends on where we take our starting off point, but I do feel that much of the current distress that the network is experiencing can certainly be traced back to, you know, what was called, you know, the listener democracy movement, or the take back of, you know, the period between like 1999 and 2002 or three, and the massive changes that were made in the structure of the organization legally, and the people that brought all that about at the time, you know, between the Pacifica campaign and the listener lawsuits that were filed, and the fact that you see those same people today as either creditors of the network or, you know, the same attorney who sued Pacifica 15 years ago now being so-called corporate counsel, the same litigants being in charge of the organization, making rather disastrous decisions at this point in time. And I think that trajectory is not an accident, that we see a kind of very destructive change in the course of the organization's, you know, life, as it were, and that it's the same people who did that who are here all these years later when it's come to sort of a culmination of that and is falling apart and are ready to snap up pieces of it and are even, you know, in certain instances, incorporating their own corporations to pick up the licenses. And that's pretty, looks pretty damning, at least from, you know, the perspective of many people observing what's going on right now. So I don't know which part you'd like to tackle first, because I think there's, you know, there's a lot of meat to be discussed, as it were, about, you know, what's brought Pacifica to its current state of crisis.
I would like for you to tell us what happened when you were the chairman of the national board, because then you were aware of everything going on, at least everything that came through the national office, and then as the executive editor or executive director, because you were in a unique position to see the problems. I'd like for you to tell this audience, what were the problems that you encountered, what did you do to try to correct those problems, and were your efforts to support those problems being corrected either a challenge by the rogue board or individuals, or were they giving you a helping hand in correcting them?
Well, okay, so I've listened to the Pacifica station in Los Angeles since I was a child, and my mother was involved with WBAI back in its infancy, so we have a long family history with, you know, interest in the network, but I was never involved in any of the internal issues until I was recruited for the local station board in 2007. So I came into the situation as probably a great many board members do, which is simply liking the station, feeling really good about, you know, doing something productive to support its well-being, and not really realizing the magnitude of the difficulties nor the sort of toxic internal environment until you're actually in it. You know, and my viewpoint on things has significantly changed in the last 8 years in the course of dealing with things. So, you know, when I came in and was on the local station board for 2 years before I went to the national board, and I served as the treasurer at KPFK, and then I went on to be the national treasurer for a year before being the chair 3 years in a row. And over the course of that time, seeing what goes on in hiring processes, what goes on with the financial situation, New York was in a desperately precarious financial condition when I was first seated on the board, and things have kind of, you know, steadily gotten worse within the network on many levels, simply because the really serious problems have not, there's been no point at which anyone, including myself, has been able to successfully stop what's going on and what's rotten in the organization. And you have a kind of an environment which has, in my opinion, just deteriorated over the years tremendously in terms of those basic regulatory compliance things that we were talking about last week. Stations which, you know, cannot account for anything to do with their premiums whatsoever to auditors, but what you're talking about in terms of non-fulfillment of premiums, that is epidemic in New York and has been for multiple years. And I think that's a result of the extreme financial distress of that station. If you look at what happened with putting it into 120 Wall Street, That was an incredibly expensive lease arrangement, $35,000 a month for, you know, studio and office space. Empire State, $50,000 a month, constantly going up. If we go back to the listener revolt, you know, lots of people of good conscience and goodwill, I believe, were involved with that. And I often say, you know, I wasn't there, so I can't really say what the previous board of directors was doing. But the things that you can look at is you have outside organizations dumping hundreds of thousands of dollars into the Pacifica campaign. The Pacifica campaign was started by Juan Gonzalez, co-host with Amy Goodman. And Amy Goodman had been attempting to separate Democracy Now! From Pacifica, which was a Pacifica program, in the years leading up to the Pacifica campaign. And the Pacifica campaign goes on essentially a public relations tear to take down the seated board of directors and to inspire many, many listeners to go against the foundation. You have these listener lawsuits which get filed, one of the biggest being filed by Dan Siegel, who's the current corporate counsel, with lead litigant Lydia Brazone, current board chair. And what you get out of that when they settle those lawsuits, and, you know, people think often that, like, the outcome of a legal matter is because somebody won something. Most things are settled. And what you get out of that settlement is a complete change in the structure of the organization so that it becomes a listener-member organization where, you know, the 90% of listeners who, you know, have no idea about who's in governance and really don't care to participate in the elections don't participate. And prior to that, for the whole 50 years, we didn't have that type of structure, good, bad, or indifferent. We didn't have a system of, you know, listener boards. And what you get after that is, you know, the very cumbersome democratic process that, you know, brought me into the situation, has brought, you know, certainly some good board members, but overall you have a constant state of tumult and turnover at the national level. And it doesn't lead to stability or the ability to make long-term plans for the organization. The Pacifica campaign, Amy Goodman comes out of that with the first multi-million dollar contract to an individual or an individual show that Pacifica has ever done in its entire history. So it's unprecedented, literally. The show is broken away from the network, and after that, the network is obligated to pay millions of dollars to a former employee over a period of years, pay the satellite fees, pay for the distribution. And then that gets renewed again in 2007 by Dan Siegel, and doesn't even account in the new renewal for changes in technology. Like, we had the right to duplicate CDs, but by 2007 it's a television show, so people aren't ordering CDs, they're ordering DVDs, but Pacifica doesn't get those duplicating rights anymore. So that's a couple $100,000 a year down the tubes. Our news department, we had Pacifica Network News. It gets broken away during the entire, you know, tumult of the 2000 period and gets turned into FSRN, another multi-million dollar contract with money flowing out of the organization. So you can look at some of the results of this, and you can quibble and argue about whether or not people were acting in good faith, and I'm sure some people were and some people were not. But you end up with a listener-sponsored organization, a community radio network, and you can argue whether it's community radio or not, but certainly listener-sponsored, having to pay out tremendous sums of money that it did not have to pay out before, having very expensive elections and a lot of litigation, having turnover in its executive staff at an unprecedented rate, which leads to things like lawsuits for various types of, you know, failures in human resources, sexual harassment, et cetera. So I look at the 15 years and I say, you can see this steady decline of the organization post 1999 through 2003, and it has been detrimental to the survival of the organization, and it's also led to this tremendous factional fight back and forth of people trying to gain control of the organization, trying to maintain control, trying to take it from each other, so that no one focuses on actually any of the nuts and bolts of running a radio network. And what I encountered, surely, because, you know, and that all leads to a decayed situation in which things like petty embezzlement is, it's easy for that to occur because there's no oversight. There's nobody able to run the place, and anyone who tries gets run out of the organization. And I found that, you know, I certainly enjoyed support from my caucus on things like, you know, hey, you have to turn over the books because we actually have to conduct an audit here. But if you look at just one station, you know, KPFA, which is next door to the national office, up until the very day I was fired, we had received I don't know, a dozen, two dozen emails from the business manager there as to why the books could not be reconciled still, even though they were over a year overdue, and how they would be ready at any moment up until the day I was fired, when my controller was told by KPFA, basically, like, I don't have to do what Summer Reese tells me. Like, I don't have to turn over these books. And that kind of resistance is throughout the network when it comes to, you know, mandating things like lock boxes. Anything that is sort of the normal business practice for handling money is resisted at every station. And in terms of, you know, the board majority, well, they're the ones who fired me immediately during the period where I was most trying to compel compliance with things like accounting for the premiums. And that's literally like the 3 month period right before I'm fired is where I'm implementing all these policies and really pressuring people that they have to be able to reconcile these issues. They can't, you know, engage in copyright infringement. They have to tell us where they're at on their fulfillment with the public. And, you know, no one ended up having to do that once I was fired. And we can see a year and a half later, nobody's still doing that. So basically, everything that I was attempting to do during the time period that I was executive director stopped in its tracks when they fired me, because I don't believe the current majority has any interest in resolving those problems and seeing to. If you look at what's going on in Los Angeles now, in fact, they are accelerating the decline dramatically and kind of crashing and burning what was at least a, you know, a somewhat functional station, even though it had significant problems also in the last few years. So,
okay, Summer, I have some short questions to ask you. I'd like short answers,
sure.
All right?
Sure.
We cannot mention names. I'd just like you to tell us yes or no, because you were a fiduciary, you were the top person. Do you have any knowledge, firsthand knowledge or proof that there was copyright infringement or pirating of artists' CDs or DVDs while at Pacifica?
I would say if you take multiple employees confirming the occurrence of things combined with vendor and complaints, I would say yes. I considered what I had in hand to be sufficient that I proceeded with, you know, directing people to do things like remove their duplicating machines and having our FCC counsel draw up copyright guidelines so that all managers would be informed that it was extremely
illegal. Is it not,
illegal.
Okay, is it not correct that your, in the Pacifica National Attorney sent a letter stating that copyright infringement was serious and that you could be fined upwards of $250,000 per copyright infringement, and that could virtually bankrupt the entire foundation and have the FTC take away Pacifica. Is that true or not?
We received it the very day I was fired at midnight. That's the guidance we got back that same day.
Okay. Is it not also true that there is what is called a 30-day requirement by the Federal Trade Commission that when you promise that you've taken money and you do not deliver those premiums, that that in itself, based upon the number of premiums going back years, could have led to tens of millions of dollars in fines and the revocation of the license for Pacifica, a single station, or even all the stations, and put it into receivership?
It could certainly potentially carry those types of consequences. The Federal Trade Commission takes it seriously.
Is it your impression that the professional program directors, those responsible for selecting the programs best able to meet the needs of the listeners in a given market, were they of a high quality caliber in your personal opinion, or were these more politically correct appointees based upon how liberal or how ideological they matched the needs of the people on the board rather than the requirements of a professional program director?
Well, I would say occasionally we are able to get someone with good chops into a station, but it is hard to keep them there, and that certainly the political pressure to retain people who are inadequate to their positions or to put in people who are political cronies continues to be a real problem
okay.
in Pacifica, as evidenced by what we're seeing.
Is it true or not that because of not being able to do simple audits and show the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that the stations were up to date in compliance with the rules, that we have lost millions of dollars that would have been given to Pacifica and hence its stations because of gross negligence on the part of the network of not providing the Corporation Public Broadcasting what it wanted?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, that's a two-pronged issue with the CPB. You know, they did an audit on Pacifica prior to the time that I was executive director, and they found both that the accounting was not proper, that it was commingled and not properly categorized, and that was fixed in terms of accounting procedures. But the other issue was failure to have proper meeting notice requirements met in compliance with the Communications Act, and that is something where I appointed one of our technical staff as a CPB compliance officer, but it still comes down to the local stations to actually make sure that they document their meetings properly, publicly notice them, supply the documentation, and we still were having tremendous difficulty, particularly with the East Coast, in terms of that compliance, and then you have the certified independent financial audits. And without those, the Communications Act compliance is necessary for CPB funding. The certified financial audit is necessary for everything. It's necessary for CPB funding. So you have to have both of those things met for them. But the audit is also necessary simply to stay compliant as a nonprofit organization and be able to legally solicit funds in any of these jurisdictions. So when you go past a certain point, you're risking everything to do with your nonprofit status and whether or not you're violating the law to continue to solicit money from the public when you are not providing the appropriately independently audited financial statements because you receive money from the public. So I think Pacifica is in a state of lack of regulatory compliance that far exceeds compliance with CPB regulations at this point.
Okay, I'd like for you to hold your thoughts, so Maurice. Let us now go to Utrice Lead. Utrice Lead is a civil rights activist, a journalist, and was the co-founder and managing director of the City Sun weekly newspaper, which covered African-American issues in New York. She has served as the general manager for WBAI in New York and was the host of its talk radio program, Talkback, for 21 years. She also was the national program director for Pacifica, and it was against her that some of the greatest vitriol, some of the greatest personal attacks occurred. They were using her as the lightning rod to say, this is everything that's wrong with Pacifica. I was there at that time. I saw. And just a personal note, the person who was actually writing the attack ads, where people were meeting with this person in their home, and this person was paying for all this. One day I simply got a person came to my office and says, you know, why don't you join us? I don't join these groups when what you're doing is wrong. And he said, what do you mean wrong? And I said, look at each one of these things you're attacking Utrice Lead for. First, have you ever spoken with Utrice Lead? No. Did you actually do any research to see whether or not what you're doing is correct? Here's what the person said. It's irrelevant if it's correct. It's the impression that it makes. So in other words, you're willing to do what the CIA does and disinformation and provocateurs do. You simply lie about someone. You destroy the reputation. And the left, which has no critical capacity for observation, all of the media outlets, all the people on the left would just join in this one-sided beating. That's how I can best describe it. So I said, unless you are an absolute gutless coward, you go down and you meet with Utrice Lead and you challenge her on each one of these points. This person did. What was interesting at this meeting, every single point that was being distributed to tens of thousands of people to attack BAI, everyone was wrong. Utrice very calmly said, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. Now, here's the point. Did it change the person's attitude? No. That's the danger of self-righteous, ideological, ramrod, rigid, true believers. It's almost like a crusader who doesn't care about the people they're killing. They're doing it for some supposedly higher cause. I was so offended by this person's lack of integrity, I had nothing to do with him for years. But that is just my personal firsthand accurate observation. On a different program, I'll tell you about the 453 people I interviewed to see the truth of what happened and how the public has never been told the truth. And those who think you know the truth, trust me, you don't. You don't. And one day I will show you the truth, and some of your heroes will no longer look so heroic when you see how you were lied to, manipulated, and used. Let's go to Utrice Lead. Nice to have you with us, Utrice.
Thank you so much, Gary. Good to be with you.
Tell us your history of where you see Pacifica went off the rails and ended up in this massive mess that it is today.
Well, by the time I got to WBAI specifically, and I got there because my dear friend, my late friend, Samori Marksman, reached out to me and asked me to come aboard because he was interested in building the station. He had been named program director at the time, and I knew him from his work and dedication to the community. So he asked me to come aboard, and I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. But by the time I got there, in the preceding decades, as a matter of fact, there was a long and protracted and bitter struggle within the network for other than white voices. And this was a long struggle. It was, in fact, in the throes of a racist reaction then, because they had locked out the voices of African-American and Latino hosts who had something to say and who had very strong ties to the community. So as liberal and progressive as WBAI and the Pacifica Network itself claimed to be, it was, in fact, gripped with racist the badges of slavery. And it was a long, long haul before I came along. So I was a beneficiary, a second generation after that struggle. When I came into WBAI, I could not believe the state of chaos that was the order of the day. WBAI was a place that I found, and I witnessed it with my own eyes, where people would come and pick up their drugs. People would be selling them out of the station. The station was just absolutely filthy. In fact, I was known that at staff meetings, one of the pet peeves that I had was, why can't we just have a clean place to sit and do our work? In fact, I was denied a place to do my work. I was denied a salary for more than 2 years by the then manager. And really, it didn't bother me too much because I really was dedicated. And I also understood the vision that Samori had, which was to bring the station in line with a market that was ready and available and wanting it. And that was a larger market being of the urban market, African-American, Latino, Caribbean, African community in the city of New York, the activist community. And it would have added great dimension to WBAI. And it was in that spirit that I participated at WBAI. I had asked him, he said, I have problems. I have a dead zone. I said, give me your deadest zone. And it was at 3 o'clock. I said, I'll take it. And in short order, I built it. I built the audience. It became one of the most popular programs that we had. In fact, it was one of the most popular programs in afternoon drive time in the city of New York. And it was also a very important part of building the financial support for the station, because people, the listeners, were very, very enthusiastic in supporting the station.
Now, let's go to the crisis, where there was a group of people, relatively small group of people, who decided that Pacifica should change. I will not ascribe anything to their motives because I do not know their motives. I only know the outcome. But during that period of time, you went from being a host of a show, popular show, for 21 years, to being asked to become interim station manager. And then that's when all the attacks against you occurred, and that's when the divisiveness for the final effort to take over Pacifica completely from what it was and the people, and to form it in their own unique dynamic. Tell us about that transition period, please.
Well, WBAI at that time still was being run as a kind of fiefdom. The general manager at the time was most ineffective and, in fact, had a number of union actions against her. I speak as a former shop steward. There were many actions taken against the station for union violations. But in the middle of all of that chaos, one person seemed to be thriving and doing very, very well. And that person then systematically began to build a shadow operation within the station. So it was a station within the station. That person was afforded any number of considerations that even the person who began to put the station back on solid footing, and I'm referring again to Samori Marksman, was denied. As a matter of fact, at the time of his death, he was begging and pleading for a raise to give him the ability to take care of his family. It was a most chaotic and uneven situation, but one person was very astute in reading that in the middle of all of this chaos, a whole different agenda could be pursued, and she systematically went after that and constructed it so that while she was building her company within the company and being given as much latitude to do that and support, as a matter of fact, to do that, the station was going to hell in a handbasket on the other side.
Okay, well, since that person is not here to defend themselves, please do not mention their name.
Sure.
Now, take us through the time when the national board members were being systematically harassed. It was a one-sided fight. I was spending 8 hours a day talking with all of them on both sides of the issue, trying to find out why this attack was occurring and why none of the people were challenging him in return. Now, these were all volunteers on the national board, and all but two were people of color. And yet they were being attacked, and many of them were educated with PhDs. They had worked themselves up and were donating their time and energy for Pacifica and different stations. Every single one of them was purged. In fact, there were 56 progressive people, including Pacifica National News, one of the best news services in the United States, an award-winning news service. All of them were purged. While this was happening, a relatively small group of people were celebrating victory after victory. It was very easy to have a victory if you don't have anyone fighting back. And I saw it. I saw the dirty tricks, not for today, but on another program. I can promise you, when you were talking about drugs at BAI, who do you think went down there on a Saturday with a person I cannot mention and cleaned up the drugs? And one person in particular who I challenged that if I ever saw him again in the studio selling drugs on all the card tables, you could buy any drug you wanted, and stealing every piece of equipment in the station. In fact, one of my donated $1,300 portable tape recorders for use by the news department, a guy was walking out the elevator when we were going in, and I said, I saw my name on it, and he had just bought it for $75. I gave him $100, bought it back, and went upstairs. But I will save all of that, all of the things I know, for another day. But that was the environment that you were discussing. So I can confirm that what Utrecht said was correct. But then started the real dirty tricks, where people started to play really bad, and they were playing against a group of people, as Ken Ford told me from Washington, D.C., who sat on the national board, came from PFW. He said, I'm not going to fight these people. I'm not going to get in the gutter. I don't know how to fight that way. I'm a professional business person. I donate my time to give some business sense to this group, so I'll just resign. And he was the former president of the national board. And one by one, they all left. And then the group took over. It was a master Machiavellian play. It was brilliant. It was, you have to give them, all of them, an A+, because the entire liberal establishment bought it.
But it was also
criminal. You didn't have
criminal.
Even a dissenter willing to say a thing against the people who took power and then began the process of privatizing the assets for their own needs. Again, no one said, this isn't right. You know, weren't we told that Save Pacifica so nobody, Rupert Murdoch and others, won't sell it? And then it became the process. And I watched this, and I just watched the entire disintegration of the ethic of the so-called liberal establishment during that period of time. Your thoughts, please.
Well, it was also quite criminal. These actions were very criminal in their nature. For one thing, the then executive director had to split up her family, including her 12-year-old twins. Shots were fired at her house. In my case, people were sent, in fact, to basically invade my building and to cause my neighbors to know that they're living next door to some kind of an undesirable tenant. I was followed day and night. These are the kinds of things that they did. And we were clear that we were targeted because the stakes were quite high, because the calculation at the time was if we were to terrorize these people into quitting, or if we were to terrorize the board into firing these people, that they would have free rein of the entire network. And this shadow corporation that was formed within the Pacifica Corporation would then be able to spin off and would have been in a very good position to thrive and then perceive the same organization that spawned it as its competitor and then snuff it out. They followed the plan. I called it 16 years ago. It is exactly what is happening today. I said it. Clearly, this is what is going on. We knew what was going on. And unfortunately, the success was the use of race to get people to believe, well, it's, you know, they are going to, by then we had a significant percentage of leaders within Pacifica. The executive director was an African-American woman. She brought in a couple of people, myself included, at the next highest level of management within the national organization, and it began to filter down. One of the things I did, for example, was get a new union put in. Only one person belonged to the Screen Actors Guild, or AFTRA, and I brought in AFTRA, and it was a very smooth transition. But it was to afford the workers, and we streamlined the job descriptions and we streamlined the operations. It was working very well. And because it was working so well, because we had done so many good things in such a short time and with such stunning success, all the more vitriolic was the resistance, all the more intentional their decision to break up Pacifica if they couldn't have it run the way they wanted it to run. So this was something I called 16 years ago. You may recall, Gary, that you were at the station one day. I asked you to accompany me to a room, and from floor to ceiling were premiums that had not been mailed out to listeners for more than 5 years. These were the kinds of things I had to do. There was no record at the front desk, as is required by law for public inspection. WBAI had so many outstanding legal complaints against it. That's one of the things I had to do. And then we had the day-to-day administrative issues in which we streamlined the operation, so the chaos was not there anymore. And since this program of building a shadow company thrived on chaos, I was seen as, of course, an impediment to that. When Bessie Wash, the then executive director, who brought in a whole new management team at all of the stations, said that she was going to quit, we all, to a person, said, "We are quitting with you. We are in solidarity with you. We will walk out with you." And so we did.
Okay. Please hold your thoughts. Let us now go over and say hello to Tracy Rosenberg. Tracy is currently the executive director of Media Alliance, a Democratic communications advocacy organization for California. She is a former board member for the Pacifica KPFA station in Berkeley, as well as a former Pacifica National board member from 2010 to 2013, and the National Treasurer from 2011 to 2013. Her website is mediaalliance.org. Nice to have you with us, Tracy.
Hi, Gary.
Tracy, your observations from your personal journey through Pacifica.
Sure. Well, let me start off by saying that unlike Summer Reese, I was in fact present in the 1999 to 2002 period that's being discussed. And with all due respect, I can't say that the characterization that I'm hearing here sounds entirely accurate to me. But what I'll say is that a tumult as Pacifica experienced during that time was caused by significant problems in the organization. What links together now and then, which I think is really important to state, and we've kind of hinted at it somewhat, is the attempt to privatize the assets. In other words, the attempt to chop off parts of Pacifica and bring them under the individual control of one internal force or the other, one set of insiders, as it were. And whether you do this in an organization that doesn't have members at all and therefore can't fight back, that was the 1999 version, or you do it as it's being done today with what is largely a silent majority, a silent membership that's essentially not voting and not following any of the details, is really, I think, more a question of style than a question of substance. In other words, it's largely the same thing. Let me give you an example. As people, I think, are starting to hear, this version of Pacifica right now hasn't filed a timely audit in 2 years. As a result, it's been disqualified from CPB funding and has basically forfeited about $2 million in free public media grant funding. And this is an organization that could really use that $2 million. And if people don't no, my retirement from Pacifica has largely consisted of trying to get some information out about what's going on. So I've been listening to all of these meetings, all of which are on the stream. They're streamed over the internet. Nobody listens, but I've been listening and I've been trying to tell people in a fairly short version what's been going on. And when we talk about these significant failures that could lead to the loss of nonprofit status, failures that are causing millions of dollars to literally not come through the door, here's what I hear. I hear people saying, well, it's not my station, it's your station. Well, my station's doing fine. It's your station that's causing all the problems. In other words, when you use the word turf wars, when you use the word provincialism, this is essentially what you're hearing. What you hear is chaos, and what you hear is one-upsmanship, and what you hear is sort of a blame derby. And the question here is why? Because it's one 501c3 organization. All five stations live or die together. When you are on the national board, your job is to look out for the welfare of the whole thing, all five stations and the archives. So there is no, well, it's WBAI's fault or whatever you hear. So what's going on? What is this kind of artificial chaos? And what is this fantasy that people are serving the interests of one-fifth of a nonprofit organization that happens to be the only progressive media network left in the country and holds tens of millions of dollars in public media infrastructure? And I say this as a media advocate, belongs to the public. Well, then you look at board members opening up in secret, not-for-profit found organizations in order to capture the assets if, like, maybe there's a catastrophe and something goes wrong and Pacifica can't function. Well, it's not functioning, and they're the ones that are causing it not to function. So you see here that you essentially have people working in order to facilitate the movement of things away from this 501c3 organization into some other entity. And it is correct to say that that also happened in the 1999 to 2003 tumult. And we are at that place once again. We are at that place where essentially forces inside of the network, and I would call them the current board majority, are essentially working to force a catastrophe that will cause things to move out of the organization into other entities. This is theft. This is theft of public media. And it's happening right in front of our eyes. And it's not the first time.
As the treasurer, did you see financial irregularities happening at the national office or through any of the stations?
Yes,
Okay. Were these brought to the attention of any outside authorities, or was this kept inside Pacifica?
When it came to financial irregularities, they were largely implied. We were largely dealing with systematic failures to report and what that indicated about what was probably going on underneath the surface. When things did surface, they were largely dismissed as mistakes, incompetence, and we had firings, we had turnovers, we had lawsuits, we had sort of, we dealt with financial malfeasance as a personnel matter. When in fact, it probably, essentially, was not. Because we got rid of bad people, we replaced them, same problems. So it wasn't about the people. It was about the system. It was about something larger than replacing Tweedledum with Tweedledee.
Tracy,
with Tweedledum, excuse me.
Tracy, how would you change Pacifica, the national management, in order to, and the local station management, how would you change any of this in order to get the stations and the foundation functioning, or do you believe it's possible based upon the type of governance they have and the constant seeking of power by individual groups mm-hmm. coming in?
Yeah, well, Pacifica is an organization that, let's face it, has had a long institutional resistance to any kind of change. Everybody says the highlight of Pacifica was the 1960s. That is now 50 years ago. We're still struggling with transitioning out of the 1960s. That's the reality. So you're talking about an organization where there's a tremendous amount, and I think that Chutrice was right about this, vitriol directed at anyone who tries to sort of, you know, push the engine forward. What we were dealing with in 99 and to 2003, and I think it's correct to say that things about programming change, things about covering communities, were problematic and had been problematic throughout Pacifica's history. And people really were rising up and saying, enough of that. We don't just want college professors on this station. We also want to hear from people on the ground. And that's legitimate and fair and appropriate and the way that it should be for a network that is trying to say what isn't being said elsewhere. However, in order to open up the programming process, what we did was open up the governance. We opened up the hiring. We opened up the financial record keeping. We created basically a mess in order to sort of filter that into the programming, that if we had an open governance structure, somehow by osmosis, that would cause the programming to update. Well, that's exactly what didn't happen. The programming has remained entirely stuck, and the basic operations of how you keep a not-for-profit organization going, regulatory compliance, development, administration, subscription, sending out premiums, all of these sort of basic functions became totally dysfunctional. Increasingly so. They were never great. They got worse and worse and worse and worse, and now we are at a point where we can't even start our audit 3 months after it was due. We can't start it. We don't actually have a financial record-keeping system at this point because it has been democratized, and the problem is it's democratized, but it doesn't add up. So you look at sort of those kinds of functions, and those functions belong to the executives of a 501c3. And there's a hierarchical structure that goes out to the stations where you run a professional organization. And we have been looking at the systematic assault on the integrity of the central 501c3. The national office is a fragment. It's a shell. It's a tent. I mean, you go in there, there is nobody there. There are three people running around looking harassed. They have no administrative capacity. They have no bandwidth. Most of them don't have that much experience at what they're doing. They are struggling. So the whole business of keeping the business side, as it were, going is gone. And we use this local control mantra as if it means something. And what it really means is
destroy the functionality of the organization so we can grab the pieces out. That is essentially what the board majority is doing to the organization right now, and setting up private nonprofits on the other side to grab things after the catastrophe that they're causing goes down. So you have to accept that this is one 501c3 organization. You have to accept that it needs a strong and vibrant national office. You have to accept that certain kinds of organizational change are going to come from the top. For example, Pacifica's money problems. Okay, there's not enough money. That's understood. But you have a situation where at one station you can be literally unable to pay for the health benefits and on the verge of having them canceled when another station is putting in brand new carpets. Why? Because the national office has no ability to look at all of the financial obligations that the organization has and say health benefits for our employees in Washington is more important than brand new carpets in Los Angeles. So we're going to put off the carpets and we're going to take care of the health benefits in D.C. because that's a higher priority. We can't do that. We don't do that. And so you have a situation where you've gone so anti-centralization that you're essentially being insane. You're essentially throwing the organization over the side of a bridge. And you have board members saying, well, it's L.A., it's our money, we want carpets, so F them over in D.C. And that's not the way a 501c3 can function. That brings us to the brink of catastrophe. And the fact that we continue to do it, that we continue to make these ongoing mistakes and act as if it's no big deal, is a symbol that the folks on the board do know what they're doing. The board majority knows exactly what it's doing. It's forcing a catastrophe for essentially its own aggrandizement. And that aggrandizement is financial, and that aggrandizement also relates to programming and power and having a megaphone for people who want access to that megaphone controlled and in their sole power and authority.
Tracy Rosenberg, I appreciate this insight. I will offer some final thoughts as we complete this discussion. I do not believe that any of the stations are going to survive in their current state. I believe that it is not humanly possible because of the problem of having people who want things done their way, right or wrong. It's their power that they're seeking to maintain, whether it's a program that's been on the air for a long time and has no audience, doesn't raise any money, acts as a soapbox, a nice ego-stroking position, but nobody can take them off the air. I believe that because of the constant input of negativity that and the seeking of the turf and controlling the turf, I believe that it will not go forward. Instead, what I would suggest is that sooner rather than later, Pacific will find itself in a legal crisis that it will not be able to get out of. I cannot say more than that at this time. But there is a great deal that is going to be coming forward in the very near future that will challenge Pacifica and how it's been doing business. What do I recommend? I recommend to all the programmers, meet and decide where the future is. It is my impression, my belief, that the future is on the internet. Land-based stations are very expensive, that they are not, unless you're extraordinarily well-run and have a good board of trustees who have deep backgrounds in the field of raising money and running a station, as many do. In fact, in Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, Houston, and Berkeley, you have dozens of nonprofit organizations supporting nonprofit stations where you do not have this vitriol, you do not have this self-serving interest. You have professionally run and really good quality stations. So BAI and Pacifica are no longer unique. For a long time, you had no choice. You had to listen. Today, there are thousands of opportunities and forms to listen. And we don't have a young audience. The average age of a person listening to Pacifica stations is between 68 to 71 years of age. So that can't be gotten today. It's too late. There are times in life where you had the right idea, but it's the wrong time. And good people have some good ideas, but it's not going to happen because you don't have control over the people, or the people who are in control are out of alignment with your ideology of how to go forward. So I believe that people should look in at two ways. One, to take your best programming, that which deals with international issues and important national issues from syndicated programs like Bonnie Faulkner's Guns and Butter and Project Censored and other programs, and there's probably about 20, that there may be more, but those are the ones I'm personally aware of, and stream them over the internet. Therefore, people can get them. You don't have to have all the fundraising. You don't have to have the overhead. You don't have to have local station boards, which are a mess. You don't have to have a national board. Instead, you have proper programming by a professional programmer who decides what is good. And if you're really good, you have a form. If you're not, you don't. And then have a second stream, a second complete audience that takes on the local community issues in every town, where you have the voices of people from the community, you have the issues that are important for people in the community, and you stream those. Now, if you want to reach younger people, that's how you get to them. If you try to bring all this onto a station that is already incapable of financially supporting itself, then you just do more of the same. But the future is the internet or portable devices. And then you can deal with your community issues. You can bring voices on that wouldn't have an opportunity otherwise. And it all has to be volunteer radio. The future is volunteer information. The idea that you could be paid a salary and work 5 days a week and do a strip of shows, that's history. That's gone. That's not coming back. The trouble is, as you said, Tracy, Pacifica has been failing at its mission for 50 years. Well, here's the problem. Other people filled the gap. Other stations, other programmers, other companies, other nonprofits, and they're doing a great job. So there's no audience there to get. If you're going to get any audience today, you have to get an audience that's already been diverted and paying attention to something else. And if you look at the numbers at all the stations, the audience is gone, the young people don't exist, the funds are not there, and that leads then to not being able to get the premiums. And then you have arguments about what are the best premiums or not best premiums. And you have the inner fighting. You have people attacking each other on the air. That's why I left PFW or KPFK and PFW. And by the way, I just simply one day I said to Roy of Hollywood, I said, Roy, after 31 years of 6 hours every Wednesday doing this show with you, my friend, I will no longer raise money to pay for the people who I consider unprofessional, who use their form for their own ideological attacks against other people. Whether they're attacking Christine Blasdale, who unfortunately and regrettably has been attacked mercilessly, and the foundation has not fired the people who have attacked her, and she doesn't have the resources or the will to sue them. She should have. They've libeled her. They've slandered her. And that's the medium. You don't have a human development director, and you don't have the human resource director to say, hey, you can't, you know, attack this person. But it goes, anyone who wants to say anything can do so, and if as long as they got a friend in the program director, station manager, or board member, they get away with it. And so this all has to stop. And the public is stopping it by simply turning it off. As this man said today, while I was getting my juice, he said, I stopped listening to BAI several years ago. I just didn't like the programming. Okay, that's caused a big loss. Not getting the premiums caused a loss. And then not wanting to hear all the turf wars caused a loss. And so the good people are either going to leave or be forced out, and then you'll be left with nothing except $100 or $200 million asset to which the final group of people, the final people left standing, can smile and say, we won. Well, they won a long time ago. The people who are going to win this won when they convinced the entire left that there was an enormous crisis and join us, and everybody, even well-intentioned, went along with it. That's when Pacifica was lost, but it had been doing some bad things long before that, as long as I've been on the air. But there are also a lot of good programs and a lot of good managers and a lot of good people also during that period of time. I can't say that today. So I look at the internet as the future. That is the one thing that can save the best shows on Pacifica, either national brands that deal with international issues or local issues. That is my suggestion. I want to thank Summer Reese, Eutrice Lead, Tracy Rosenberg for being with us. I'm Gary Knoll. This has been an extended edition of the Progressive Commentary Hour on the plight of Pacifica. Thank you for listening.